Featuring Slippers.
Hey everybody, welcome to F This Movie. My name is Patrick Bromley. I am joined today for a discussion of Ridley Scott's Prometheus by JB in 3D.
The trick is not minding that it's in 3D.
Like I said, you're listening to F This Movie, which you can find at fthismovie.blogspot.com. Like us on Facebook, facebook.com/fthismovie. Follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/fthismovie. And email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. We're about a third of the way through with our 30 stars of summer. Every day we get a new actor, and you're supposed to watch a movie that you've never seen starring that actor, and then write about it at our website at fthismovie.blogspot.com.
50 words or less.
Yeah. So far we've watched Kurt Russell movies, Jimmy Stewart movies. I'm already blanking on everybody else. Catherine Keener was in there.
I got to watch the Gremlins 2 Blu-ray.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Christopher Lee, he was in there. And coming up, a bunch more people. So make sure you participate in that. JB, have you seen anything good lately?
Yes. I finally got to see Moonrise Kingdom,
yes,
which the studio is releasing at a snail's pace. Let's start with two and see how it goes.
The deal is everybody gets a turn, right? We all get to see the movie one at a time.
And I guess it was successful at those two theaters because my son went and said it was very crowded. So they've decided that four would be an acceptable second weekend strategy. And one of the new theaters was close enough so that we went. And I think there's some Wes Anderson fans who felt that he sort of, for lack of a better word, gone astray with things like, I think real Wes Anderson fans tend to love Rushmore and Tannenbaums the best.
Yes.
And that Life Aquatic and Darjeeling and maybe even Fantastic Mr. Fox are maybe seen as lesser Wes Anderson.
Okay.
Although I'm a really big fan of Life Aquatic. And
really?
That didn't happen until I saw it a second and third time.
Okay.
But there's a lot to like in that film. Moonrise Kingdom, his new film, is very much a return to form. It almost forms a trilogy,
okay,
of sorts with Rushmore and Tannenbaums. He's back in J.D. Salinger territory,
right,
what I call him. And it was interesting. The other night on Mad Men, there was a scene that made my family in our family room look at each other and say, "That seems like a Wes Anderson movie," and it did.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The museum.
Kids at the museum, yeah.
And I thought that was interesting because my first thought when that scene was going on the TV screen was, this seems like a scene out of a J.D. Salinger novel. And I don't think Wes Anderson rips off J.D. Salinger at all.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's similar themes, mm-hmm, and similar concerns. And if you are going to model yourself after someone, how wonderful that a modern filmmaker is using J.D. Salinger and not, I don't know, the woman who wrote a Twilight ripoff or something. Once again, we're in the realm of childhood, this theme that Wes Anderson is very attracted to. I can't remember a movie recently where I found every single moment as delightful.
Okay.
And this is like a cliche. This is like Gene Shalit. I didn't want it to end. It was just so good,
okay,
in so many ways.
Wow.
And I'm not going to spoil anything, but it is funny and touching and so well observed in that art direction that drives some people crazy, but that I love. If you're a big, big fan of Rushmore or Tannenbaums, you have to see this. It's so good.
I wanted to see it just because I like Wes Anderson, but the trailers did not inspire a lot of confidence in me, only because I just feel like he just keeps making the same movie, if that makes sense. The movie started getting really positive reviews, and obviously my curiosity was piqued, and in the last week or so, I've been really anxious to see it, and now your review makes me want to see it even more. Because I do like his style, but it just seems like I just felt like he was making the same movie a couple times.
And I think that's a valid criticism, although I would argue, and when you finally see it, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. I think this one gets into an area.
Yeah.
That he's never explored. That's like, well, yeah, at some point, I think maybe you know what I'm talking about, even though you haven't seen it. You'll know what I'm talking about, and it's handled with taste and aplomb. I'll just leave it at that.
Life Aquatic was, I mean, a departure, but not one that I was totally on board with. It was different enough from his other stuff that it didn't feel exactly like all of his other movies, but I have yet to warm to that movie.
I know my son thinks it jumps the shark when the pirates show up.
That's a possibility, yeah.
But there's a lot of things in that movie I really like, especially Bill Murray's performance.
Sure.
And I'm so glad that Wes Anderson and Bill Murray hooked up, because to talk about, it's almost like Scorsese and De Niro, mm-hmm. that you get these amazing performances. But I think maybe Murray is getting typecast in Wes Anderson films, because the part he plays in Moonrise Kingdom is a little, I think we've seen this one before.
Well, he's almost getting typecast in other people's movies based on his performance in Wes Anderson movies, you know.
Very much. Although before Moonrise Kingdom, they showed a trailer. Oh, my Lord, it's so oddly titled.
The one where he plays...
FDR.
Yeah.
And that looks really good.
Okay.
I you can't go by the trailer, but right. It's coming out this fall. Laura Linney's in it, and Bill Murray plays FDR.
I am very anxious to see Moonrise Kingdom, so...
And we did the podcast on the year so far, and we were sort of looking at what was coming.
Mm-hmm.
There were some comments posted to the website, like, JB really sounds like a miserable son of a bitch. And for a while, you defended me, but then it was like, no, I went back, and that's pretty much what he said. When we did that podcast,
yeah,
I didn't know that Moonrise Kingdom was the new Wes Anderson film.
Oh, really?
I knew there was a film coming out with a strange title, so... Right. Had I known that, I would have said, well, yeah, this is going to be a great year. The film is called Hyde Park on the Hudson, with some assist from our unpaid intern. My wife just came down into our sanctum sanctorum with her laptop and made us aware of the title of the Bill Murray film. So thank you, sweetie.
Thank you. I saw a movie that I'm going to talk about for a minute, where I'm going to possibly destroy my credibility on this podcast, but nothing like going down in flames. It's going to present a problem for me, I think, later in our discussion of Prometheus. I saw Snow White and the Huntsman, and I really liked it. And I think I'm kind of alone in that, because the movie made money, but didn't get great reviews. I thought there was a lot of stuff to like. It's very, very beautiful. The photography, the special effects, everything about the way that it's put together is incredible. It has a lot of problems. The performances are uneven. There are gaps in the story. I liked that, you know, I saw the trailer and I thought, oh, they're just going to do what? Like the dark, edgy Snow White where she wears a suit of armor.
Yeah.
And that's not Snow White. And that's not really what the movie is. She does, in fact, wear a suit of armor at one point. But the movie does attempt to stay true to the whole story, while certainly playing around with some of the mythology, for lack of a better word. But I appreciated the fact, A, that they stayed, you know, true to the basic beats of the story, where we have the magic mirror and the poison apple and the huntsman and the dwarfs. I mean, you didn't even know, based on the trailers, that the dwarfs were in the movie. And they're played by all these great actors, Ray Winstone and Nick Frost, and that special effect is amazing, by the way. Way better than, like, weird skinny Chris Evans in Captain America. the score is gorgeous, so I like that they stayed true to it. It's a very sort of, kind of a dark movie that they really kind of, they don't try and necessarily distance themselves from the fantasy aspects, and that's why I wouldn't recommend the movie to you, because you're not a big fantasy fan. And this movie kind of doubles down on, it goes all in on the fantasy stuff.
Based on the trailer, I think the only reason I would want to see it was because of the way it looks.
Yeah.
Like you said, that for the art direction and the cinematography. The only reviews I've read, which haven't been many, because I kind of crossed that off my list a long time ago, was... The critics concentrated on the performances,
mm-hmm.
and said that Mopey was not the best Kristen choice to play Snow White.
Perhaps not. The way that the role is written, I think she's fine. Now, the role is underwritten, perhaps, to suit her strengths, which are limited. I liked that it really represented sort of a singular vision. And that's one of the things that I've liked about a lot of movies so far this year. Whether it was even Avengers definitely represented Joss Whedon's vision. Moonrise Kingdom, from what you're describing, is definitely a singular vision, even to some extent Prometheus, which we're going to talk to and talk about, not talk to. I talked to the movie last night.
Dear
he
Prometheus.
Doesn't want to appear on the podcast. You know, does represent a vision. But here's the thing. And I like that the movie is about more than you think it's about. It's not just necessarily retelling Snow White. I think it's very much about, in the way that Sucker Punch is sort of about the roles of women in society or in pop culture, I think Snow White and the Huntsman is also very much about that. And it does some things where it subverts the story in the way that, like, Beauty and the Beast, the 46 version or whatever, yeah, that we talked about on my favorite movies podcast, kind of plays some of those same games. The point is this. I can't even necessarily recommend the movie to a lot of people, because I think a lot of people will come out of it and say, why the hell did you like that? That was garbage. Certain movies just speak to us, and when we sort of fall in love with something, we're willing to overlook its flaws. When a movie works for us, it just works. And so I end up filling in some of the gaps in the story, just rationalizing, like, no, that's what this is, and interpreting things that maybe aren't there, because I really liked the movie. Which perhaps is a good place to lead us into Prometheus.
Right, and once again, we're engaging in the dubious trope that both of us saw it separately, and neither of us knows what the other one thinks of it. Although I suspect that Patrick and I know each other well enough right now that if we were made to go into separate corners and write down what the other person thought of it, I bet we could do that.
Probably. I was excited to see Prometheus. I thought the trailers looked good. I like Ridley Scott, you know, when he's doing good movies. I was excited that sort of this adult R-rated science fiction movie was coming out during the summer. And for no other reason, I mean, I'm glad that the movie exists for that reason, that you know, basically in the summer we get one big movie a week.
Yes.
And so it's kind of like, well, what's this week's movie, and is it good or bad or whatever? And I appreciate the fact that this week's movie was this sort of adult, thoughtful, in air quotes, science fiction movie.
This week's big movie, unless you're eight and pining for Madagascar.
It's not the kind of movie that usually comes out in the summer. So I appreciated that about it. And I also appreciated the fact that it has all of the country talking about the Alien franchise again, and rewatching Alien and Aliens, and sometimes Alien 3 and Alien Resurrection, although not necessarily. So it has those movies back in the conversation, and I appreciate that about Prometheus. I was very excited to see it. Having said that, I don't think my reaction to it is a function of my expectations. I don't think that I went into it expecting it to be brilliant, and when I didn't feel like it was, I walked away particularly angry that the movie failed to live up to what I wanted.
Okay, well then, now we're dealing with very complicated reactions, because as Patrick has pointed out, the two of us usually do podcasts on movies we both love.
Yes.
And they're Chris Farley shows. And this one's going to be quite a bit different. I was looking forward to it a lot,
mm-hmm,
and it was actually better than I thought it was going to be.
Okay.
But it's kind of a mess.
Yeah.
And part of it is a forgivable mess, because I give this film amazing amounts of credit for being ambitious.
Okay.
Or perhaps having the pretensions of ambition.
Yeah.
Well, let's cut to the chase.
Yeah. We're going to talk spoiler-free for a little while, so go ahead and keep listening. At a certain point, we're going to have to get into spoilers. We'll let you know.
That I'm watching the film, and I'm remembering this term that you use sometimes called fan service.
Mm-hmm.
And it quickly becomes apparent to me that one of the functions of this film is to set up the first 10 minutes of Alien.
Mm-hmm.
So as we're watching, I'm waiting for the space jockey mm-hmm. to appear, because mm-hmm. clearly that's where this is going.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing was, it seems to me, and this might be more a comment on my complete antipathy towards where Lost went in its final season, I watched this film, and I think you're looking at a film that was written by the first guy.
Right. John Spates, I believe, is the name?
Yes. Also author of the Spates catalog in Ghostbusters. And we have this sort of serviceable vehicle that plays around with some of the ideas, you know, where might the aliens have come from and where the hell did that space jockey come from? And that's what Spates adds to the party. And then Ridley Scott doesn't want to direct that script because it's awful. And so they hand it to Damon Lindelof. And this film has Lindelof's fingerprints all over it. The part of Prometheus that I give credit for being ambitious is him once again in that territory of parable, that ridiculous thing at the end of Lost where those two men are something and he's trying to create his own religion and stuff like that. That being said, you know, the question, how did life on Earth start? That's a fine question for a film.
Okay, here's the thing. I don't want to get too much...
But not for a summer blockbuster science fiction film.
No, I think that's great, man. If a summer blockbuster science fiction film is asking that question, right on. However, I don't want to get too much into this, the discussion of the reaction to Prometheus. The podcast should be about our reactions. However, the little bit of reading that I've done since seeing the movie, I really tried to avoid everything before seeing the movie. You know, the movie is already split down the middle. People really love it, or people are really not liking it.
Which I could predict.
And I didn't hate the movie. I don't even think it's necessarily a bad movie, but I don't think it's a very good one. And I don't necessarily understand the people that are loving it, but this brings me back to Snow White and the Huntsman. I understand. If you've fallen in love with the movie, you're willing to overlook all the things that this movie does wrong. And because I didn't, I wasn't sort of under its spell, I can't overlook these things. But my point is this. In some of the writing that I've read about the movie, it's getting all kinds of credit for having the balls to ask these big, important questions, right? I call bullshit on that because, yes, it asks the question, where did we come from? And then it basically answers it about halfway through the movie, and then that's it. There aren't necessarily big questions being asked, except for, like, how did life start? I mean, I almost just said it, but I don't want to do that yet until we're in spoilers. It answers that question, and then it sort of asks some new ones.
Right. There's a second, bigger question. And, again, we won't engage in spoilers yet, but when that second, bigger question gets asked, I felt that it was almost as blatant as Back to the Future 2.
Yes, yes.
Ending with...
And this is the problem. This is the cynicism.
See you next summer.
And,
again, I can't go further without spoilers.
Right, to hell with that. That's just not fair. So this movie just exists to launch a new franchise? I'm not interested in that. Make a movie that works and is good, and then if you want to make a sequel to that, because we all really liked the first movie... Go ahead and do that, but don't just assume that you're going to make a sequel, and so you sell your first movie short, and you shortchange your audience, who's left wondering, like, why did we just spend our time with that? Oh, we have to go see the next movie?
Because it almost seems that if we're plunking down our money for Prometheus, it should have included that entire story arc.
Yes!
Including that second question
yes.
that clearly the second prequel is going to answer, and... Once I realized, okay, this is the way they're going to do place setting for the space jockey, I realized that one of the functions of the next prequel we're going to inevitably get is to establish that distress call that winds up being a warning. Because once we established the space jockey, I kept saying, okay, well, now here's the next thing they're going to set up.
We're going to have to get into spoilers sooner than I
yes.
would normally like, because I have something to say about that. Let's talk about Alien real quick, though, because initially it's introduced as Ridley Scott's making a prequel to Alien, and I'm bummed out about this. I don't like prequels. I don't need a prequel to Alien, as I've said a million times, probably on this podcast. The whole appeal of Alien is there's no alien, and then all of a sudden, holy shit, there's an alien, and that's why the movie works. So now when you have a prequel to it, well, that takes away the part where there's no alien, everyone. Then... He sort of comes out and says, well, it's evolved into this other thing. And it's a totally different science fiction movie. And that I'm on board with. Ridley Scott making an original science fiction film, outstanding. He made two of the best science fiction films ever. But then, and I blame the internet on some of this, you know, because they, the internet culture can't get enough of this movie, this story. We have to leak every single new piece of information. So Ridley Scott comes out with this quote. Well, it's an original science fiction story with strands of alien DNA, right?
Literally, in some cases.
So now, okay, it's sort of a prequel to Alien, but not really. And again, some of the reviews go one way or the other. They say, you can't consider this movie a prequel to Alien. You have to take it on its own terms, right? But that's impossible. Ridley Scott bends over backwards to tie things in to Alien. So, but none of it at the service of the story that he's telling. None of the stuff that ties into Alien has anything to do with the story that this movie wants to tell. It literally exists, basically as a marketing gimmick, right? Where people will go see it because they can market it as a prequel to Alien. And they can all of a sudden sell new Alien Blu-rays the week that it comes out because we all want to go back and revisit this franchise. Because if you take away, if you change the look of the space jockey and take away a few things from about the halfway point, the movie doesn't necessarily have anything to do with Alien, and that's okay. But I also, while I was watching it, I thought, well, if the internet hadn't necessarily ruined this, if this movie came out in 1984 or something, and I just sat down to watch it, and all of a sudden I started to recognize certain signifiers from Alien, maybe that would be delightful. Maybe I wouldn't be going in expecting this prequel to Alien. And I want to talk more about the prequel aspect. We'll begin in the spoilers, because I can't think of a good prequel. I think by design they are flawed.
And it all comes down to Patton Oswalt's amazing routine about the Star Wars prequels, where, do you like Darth Vader? Would you like to see him as a kid? No.
Right.
Because he's kind of a sad kid.
I rewatched Alien.
As did my wife the night before we saw this.
And I watched it after. And you get to that shot about 15 minutes into the movie where they find the giant ship, and in the middle of this giant ship is this huge chair, and sitting in it is the space jockey with this crazy elephant face. And you are filled with so many questions. What the hell is that? Where did that come from? And Alien, which is a great movie, understands that doesn't necessarily matter. Because it's a way into the other story that it wants to tell.
Or that won't matter until decades later. We have to mine that for further profits.
Why does anyone think that explaining the origin of the space jockey makes anything better? And to the people who are, maybe I should say some of this for spoilers, but to the people who are giving this movie a pass or falling in love with it, why is no one bringing up midichlorians? Because that's all this is. This is midichlorians. This takes a thing with lots of questions surrounding it that fills us with awe and wonder and then gives us very explicit, oh, it's this, this, and this, and this.
Yes.
People are up in arms about midichlorians. No one is up in arms about the space jockey.
And I think if that's something that the filmmakers will gleefully sort of rub their hands together and say, yes, yes, that we can place the credit for that squarely in Lindelof's lap, because he has shrouded the film in this sort of faux significance that we're not saying, oh, well, they're just taking this very famous image from a much better film and then sort of tying their star to that. Because it's in the midst of all of this pretentious question asking that, well, again, are we at spoilers yet?
Okay. Before we move into spoilers, if somebody hasn't seen the movie yet, would you suggest that they see it?
Oddly enough, yes.
Okay.
I really like the look of the film. Yes. I really like the art direction.
Amazing
of the film.
Visuals in the movie.
And there's one performance in the film.
Yes.
That's delightful to watch.
Michael Fassbender.
Yes. Yes. And Dana Stevens said every time he's on screen, the film snaps to attention.
Yeah.
And it seems like he's the only one who understands the film he's in. Because you want to talk about, you said Snow White and the Huntsman had very varying performances. Mm-hmm. Everyone in Prometheus is in a different movie.
Yeah.
And wow, is it jarring.
But Fassbender's the only one who's in the movie you want to watch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In fact, an entire movie about just that character, I think, would have been a better idea.
This movie has two better options for leads, I would argue.
I kept going back and forth because my initial impression when the film was over was that the actress whose name I don't think I can pronounce.
Noomi Rapace.
Oh, is that how she?
Yeah.
Why did I think it was Rapace?
I'm not sure.
Crazy, man. I thought she was miscast.
Yeah, I don't know. I haven't seen her in Sherlock Holmes, but I saw her in the original Swedish Girl with a Dragon Tattoo, and I've yet to get on board with Noomi Rapace.
In fact, and I don't think this is spoilers, Fassbender's performance was so good. The film also features a performance by an actor playing a very, very old man. And until the end credits, I thought that was Fassbender under the makeup.
Interesting. Might have even made more sense.
It's Guy Pearce.
Thematically, yes. And lots of people have said, why Guy Pearce? We'll try and address that in spoilers. I would recommend that people see it.
I can tell you that.
Yeah.
That never occurred to me.
Okay.
Okay.
I would recommend people see it in a theater. Don't wait for it to show up on cable or get it at Redbox or watch it on Netflix or download it illegally if you're a huge douchebag.
Visually, it's very beautiful. It's what
that's the reason to see the movie.
Scott. There's a sequence with some sort of galactic sandstorm, but it's not just sand. It's all kinds of crazy stuff, and that was wild.
Yeah. I didn't see the movie in 3D because I've just been burned on 3D too many times, and I told myself, you know, when Martin Scorsese made a movie in 3D, I said, okay, I'll go see that, because here's a guy who I'm sure will know what to do with 3D. And it was Hugo, and I thought 3D added nothing to that movie, and so I kind of swore off 3D. I'm sure Ridley Scott knows how to do 3D. Everything I've read says the 3D is amazing. See it in 3D IMAX if you can. Perhaps I should have, but I just... 3D does nothing for me.
Editor's note, Patrick's comments about Hugo do not in any way reflect the thoughts and opinions.
Did you think the 3D added something to the movie?
Yes,
very much.
Did you really?
Yeah, see, I did not. But I don't think...
I don't want to make this a Hugo podcast. Yeah. I thought it lent a spirit of this being yet another gadget.
Sure. Okay.
Another...
And it was neat seeing the...
Another novelty.
The Melies, stuff, you know, in 3D. That was
cool. It made me cry.
So did Prometheus.
For a very different reason.
So see it in a theater, because if you wait to watch this movie on TV, you have to pay attention to things like character and dialogue. And that's where this movie's not going to work. See it on a huge screen with a great sound system and make up your own mind about it. I mean, it's a new Ridley Scott science fiction movie. That alone deserves to be seen, whether or not the movie is entirely successful. Okay, we are now moving into spoilers. If you have not yet seen Prometheus, or if you don't care about having the movie spoiled, I'm sorry, if you've not yet seen it, turn it off. If you don't care about having it spoiled, go ahead and keep
listening. Okay, we're now in spoilers.
Yeah.
When Sigourney Weaver showed up, I was surprised. Right? How did they keep that a secret?
That was amazing to me. So, the movie asks the question, where do we come from? And halfway through the movie, it says, aliens planted us here.
Yes.
Okay, now what? Because now it's answered. It's one big question that everyone is, you know, peeing all over themselves, talking about, oh, it asks these big questions.
And I still give the film credit. Because some films are only interested in the question, why is Adam Sandler still making movies?
I agree with that.
I
but,
have
but
to
is
give the
just
film-
asking the question enough? Don't you have to actually then deal with some of what that question implies? Do you know what I mean?
And I think the film pays lip service to that because the Fassbender robot, I don't quite think that's a spoiler,
no,
is sort of an atheist who sort of playfully... questions, especially Dr. Elizabeth Swan, our nominative lead, that she's very religious and she wears a crucifix under her spacesuit.
We know she's religious because she wears a crucifix.
And she keeps saying, because that's what I choose to believe, which the film seems to think is what makes us human. I don't know what to make of that, but there is some lip service played to a debate about, you know, faith versus facts or something.
Yes.
But it's odd when you say the film pretty much explicitly spells it out. In an odd way, it does that in the first 10 minutes. The minute you think,
yes. I didn't understand what was going on for those first 10 minutes until it sort of became clear later on.
Which is another thing I give the film credit for, that we're dealt this very abstract, very odd sequence at the very beginning.
Maybe the best part of the movie, I thought.
I would agree.
Except for some of the weird CG, but whatever.
And look, now we're in spoilers, and yet we're very cleverly not spoiling it. And then about halfway through the movie, you put two and two together and say, okay.
But Ridley Scott himself has said, oh, that might not be Earth. That might just be another planet. Well, then what is it doing in the movie? So you're saying...
If he actually said that, that's incredible.
I swear he said that in an interview.
Because the only other interpretation would be, well, like Johnny Appleseed, they went from planet to planet.
Which I guess is the implication. But then why not just say it's Earth? They could still have done that. But why not just say, yes, that's Earth?
Because maybe they're playing the game.
You just watched the creation of mankind.
For the longest time, I thought R.E.M. played this game in the realm of music, where you don't want to make it explicit what the lyrics are about. Because the more nebulous and metaphoric it is, the more people can get invested and are interested in what it means, even if it's a laundry
list.
That's
the tree of life.
Right? Even if it's nonsense, we want to have the perfect Rorschach where people can read into it. And that's fine. But about halfway through the film, we are presented with the idea that there were alien beings who are referred to as the engineers.
Space jockeys.
But I guess we're in spoilers. If a lot of this film exists to explain the space jockey, unless I was nodding off, which I wasn't, the space jockey at the end, who pilots the ship for a short period of time before boom, 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 he gets out of that chair.
Correct.
That's
not the one they find in Alien. That's what you're reverse engineering this one scene in Alien for an entire movie. That's not the same. They're not even on the same planet.
Okay. Because I'm thinking, well, now here's even more that I'm going to have to go see in a couple summers.
Right.
Because now they're leaving a lot of things open. The question that the film, I think, becomes centered on about halfway through is, if these aliens engineered life on Earth and did all these wonderful CG things, which you really need to see, and that's where we came from, it becomes clear that at a later point, they became very displeased with us and decided that they needed some sort of weapon to wipe us out.
Right.
And now we're asking, well, why did they suddenly change their mind about us?
Right.
We look a little bit like them.
We have the exact same DNA, apparently.
Yes, according to that thing. And my son's theory, major spoiler,
okay,
is that even though the film doesn't answer that question, there's some references to time in the film that indicates that the alien engineers may have become very displeased with us about 2,000 years ago.
I read that theory somewhere online.
Okay. And that perhaps Jesus Christ
was
an engineer, and we didn't treat him very well, and so they're stockpiling tens of thousands of aliens to wipe us out.
Well, they're not stockpiling tens of thousands of aliens. They're stockpiling black goo. And the black goo is magic black goo.
Yeah.
Because it does something different to everyone, depending on... Sometimes it's like an acid on your face, and then it turns you into a spider zombie. And but if you eat it and you're a man,
you get
worms in the eyes, and you start to turn into sort of a monster. But then if you get pregnant with it and you're a woman, you give birth to this weird face hugger. And then if that face hugger implants you and you're an engineer, that gives birth to the alien.
To the alien that we know and love. That, I thought, was one thing that I gave the film credit for. That if part of this film is to explain how we got this, he said, holding up a little action figure of the alien.
Which, by the way, is a horrible idea. That I don't need to know where the alien comes from.
That the human, who sort of had it in her belly for a short period of time, contributed to that. And maybe that's why the alien that we really like from the first two movies, that explains why it's a guy in a suit.
But I thought that was already explained by the fact that it came out of John Hurt.
Oh, see, in the mythology of the first film,
yeah.
I thought we're past the evolutionary stage where the alien takes different forms, and I thought every time someone gets a face hugger, the same thing would pop out.
Okay.
That it had evolved to, well, this is what it is.
Right. I don't know. I thought that...
Which, I would argue that the film Alien, the first film,
yes.
actually has evidence for what I just said, because Ash, the Ian Holm character, really seems to know a lot about what
right.
this thing is
right.
going to do and what
right.
it's going to become. In fact, that's
right.
one of my favorite moments in the first film, when it pops out, and anyone looking at the situation objectively might say, this is when it's at its most vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
It's tiny and small and weak. And remember what Ash says? Don't touch it.
Yeah.
Don't touch it. And then it gets away
right,
and grows.
Right. I thought, you know, the movie ends with this stupid tag. So, I mean, the movie proper sort of ends with Noomi Rapace asking a question like, I don't want to know where we came from. I want to know where they came from. And let's go find out why they decided to kill us. See you in the sequel.
Yeah.
And it's a bullshit cop-out ending. And then we get this other little tag where the engineer has the, you know, the chest burster comes out and it's like the baby little alien. And so now we can say, look, that's where that came from. And the special effect is shoddy because now it's CG instead of something cool like it used to be. And it's ridiculous. And it sends me out of the theater pissed off.
Considering it's the film's final punch in the gut. I mean, it's really meant to be, you know, like the hand coming up at the end of Carrie.
Right.
I thought it was really awful, not just in terms of the special effect, which was bad CGI and looked like a video game, but the final image we get
right.
is not up to what they're asking that image to do.
The second set of jaws.
It comes across as an anticlimax. It needs to be something really scary and terrifying. And it's almost like...
I almost feel like, you know, because the big, I guess, punchline is that second mouth that comes out, which the movie's famous for. But that's not the reveal that, like, oh, that's the alien. We've already figured out that that's the alien. So all that second thing does is confirm, yes, folks, that is the alien.
Yeah.
I mean, it's repetitive. I really did not like... And again, for all Ridley Scott's bullshit about, like, no, this is an original science fiction, you know, strands of alien DNA. Like, you have bent over backwards to tie this in.
I would argue
to alien.
That without Alien, this is a much worse film, because it if it were to lose all of its connections to Alien.
Okay.
But I would also argue, I have very little patience for that Damon Lindelof parable nonsense.
Uh-huh.
So let's take that off the table. I actually thought it was incredibly derivative of 2001.
Yeah.
We get to a point where we can recognize this symbol and know what it means, and we have the technology to travel to where this thing was supposedly happening, and we have technology gone berserk, so the David robot is Hal. I just
yeah.
sat there and counted the ways,
right.
And I think one place where the film really fails... And one of the 10 or 12 ways that the original Alien film is just an unqualified success, there is a sense in the first Alien film that you know who these people are.
Right.
And those actors create an uncanny sense that they have been working together for a very, very long time.
Yeah.
And that it's an ensemble. And you know, even the scene right before the chestburster where they're enjoying the
yeah.
meal, there's
yeah.
so many little interactions and innuendos going on, and you know what's going on. This crew on the Prometheus, it's amazing to me how little time they spend or how many corners they cut. Oh, biologist tries to be friends with crazy Scottish punk, and then they're going to be set up like Abbott and Costello. It's so disjointed. They're hardly ever in the same room together.
Right.
There's always there's the two that are left behind, and then there's Idris Elba and his two little stooges, and then Charlize Theron is in her luxury apartment pod. I was really disappointed by the fact that they didn't establish more camaraderie, because that's where we get the tragedy of the crew members' deaths,
right.
because they were human beings to us. Dana Stevens went so far as to call many of them red shirts.
They are. I mean, there's too many people, first of all.
The minute they show up.
There's too many people. And yeah, at a certain point, they're being killed, and you don't even know. You literally haven't seen them on camera yet. It's just like, oh, there's a guy. Oh, he's dead. And at the end, characters sacrifice themselves, and maybe we're supposed to be moved or find it noble. I mean, Idris Elba doing what he's doing, okay, fine, because we've spent some time with him, but he has his two co-pilots who very quickly make the decision to die, and it means nothing, and they're very casual about it. And it's like, all right, yeah, let's do this.
Right, the only thing they've established is that, like, in a bad World War II movie, those are the two that have a bet going on.
Oh, and then Jesus, the screenwriter, I forgot about the bet.
And the screenwriters think that that's enough? Really? That's that they have a bet going on about something. And you, as we all know, if you make a casual bet with someone, that means you're likely to sacrifice yourself for the greater good. That's just movie shorthand, really.
I was with the movie for the first half, at least. Because, again, that opening is great. Then we get all the shots of Fassbender spending time while everybody's in cryosleep, playing basketball and watching Lawrence of Arabia and dyeing his hair. And it's great because, again, he's on screen and you're interested in what he's doing.
I thought the Lawrence of Arabia stuff was great.
Yeah.
And a lot less derivative than the parable stuff that I've already spent too much time deriding. Because on the way home, my wife and I kept thinking, well, why did they pick Lawrence of Arabia? And the more you start thinking about that, that was a really interesting choice in terms of, well, what Lawrence of Arabia has in common with Alien.
Okay.
What the Lawrence of Arabia character has in common with the David robot.
Okay. They land, they decide to go exploring, even though there's only 6 hours of daylight, and as somebody pointed out on the internet, this storm that's coming, they probably should have been able to see from space, so how that takes them by surprise. I don't want to get into nitpicking the science of the movie.
There is one thing I want to nitpick.
It's a disaster. It's a disaster.
That people do things for no reason, and suddenly in the last half hour, people are doing things in the service of the story that don't make any logical sense. And I don't want to get into this thing where, well, you're looking at a big-budget science fiction film where we're sort of being asked to swallow seven pool balls, mm-hmm. and you're arguing about this pebble. But about an hour in, Numi?
Yeah.
Dr. Elizabeth Swan.
Is it Swan? I don't remember what it is.
I thought that was the one character name I could remember. Besides David. Because for the first couple minutes, I thought they were calling the Michael Fassbender robot Data. And I thought, well, that's kind of a steal, but it's David.
Dr. Elizabeth Shaw.
Shaw. It's close. About an hour in, Shaw has abdominal surgery.
Yes.
Very explicit abdominal surgery, and what yes. some people are already calling the
right.
the gory set piece of this film. And sure, for about 10 minutes afterwards, she does a yeoman's job of running and stopping and retching and keeling over, and oh my God, can you imagine having to run after you've just had abdominal surgery? This is why we have hospitals. You have to rest for days. And then it continues, and she's doing gymnastics and heroic feats of, well, darling, your stomach's just been ripped open. Is that a quibble? It's crazy.
No, it would be if that was the one thing in the movie. But the movie is filled with so many things like that. And again, not to go back to Snow White and the Huntsman, but I've heard conversations about that movie that break it down the way that I'm breaking down Prometheus and saying, why is this like this? And why it takes this shortcut? And you're right. And I just let that wash over me because I like the movie. So if you love Prometheus and you're like, well, why the hell are you assholes just nitpicking? I understand it because the movie worked for you, and so you're willing to overlook the many, many stupid things this movie does. But that's not us, and so we're going to nitpick. Because I don't think they're nitpicks. Let's talk about that scene, and then I want to go back to where the movie really falls apart. It exists to be sort of this gory set piece, and I'm trying to figure out, like, is there something to the fact
that it's this film's version of the chestburster?
The chestburster, right. And so in Alien, we have the chestburster sequence, which David Scull talks about is about the horror of childbirth, reproduction, right? And so now here it is, 2012, and is this about the horror of cesarean sections? Like, have we moved beyond natural childbirth, and now we're terrified of surgical birth.
My wife thought it was very interesting. They have this machine that you lie in and it performs surgery. Only for men. That when she initially programs the machine and she asks for a cesarean, we found it interesting that she didn't ask for an abortion. That's a surgical procedure.
Right.
Is that just the film?
Well,
plain and safe.
But the movie does, probably, the movie does all these crazy things. Like it says, she goes to say, I need a cesarean. No, this is only built for men. Which at the time I was like, well, that's the stupidest thing ever. Why do you have this thing on board that's only for men when you have a bunch of women on your crew? Why can't it be unisex?
Because
it's setting up the fact that it's Guy Pearce is secretly on board for no fucking reason. Anyway, even that beat is worthless because she has no problem getting it done anyway. She just rewords it and then gets it cut out of her, right? And then she just leaves it there and nobody has a problem with the fact that this face hugger is sitting in there. It was an icky sequence. It was effective while you were watching it because you're like, God. But it adds nothing to the movie. I mean, the whole thing about her being pregnant, the whole subplot almost adds nothing to the movie except, again, to reverse engineer. Here's a face hugger, which gives birth to the alien. You know what I mean?
Fans of this 2,000 years theory suggest that that is this film's version of the virgin birth, because it's established that she can't have kids.
Right.
And yet she can have an alien kid.
Right.
And something about an incision in your side. Again, I haven't read this on the internet, just from people who are piecing together the mythology. You have mentioned this a lot of times on the podcast and also in articles that you've written for the blog, that for the first hour, I'm with this film.
Yeah.
And it has captured me. And there's a lot to like. And in the last half hour, I see studio notes and studio notes and studio notes and studio notes. And even bigger than the surgery machine that's only for men, there's a character who becomes infected with the alien, and the Charlize Theron character, perhaps wisely, doesn't want it on the ship, and so she torches it, and he winds up sort of sacrificing himself. And then, about 10 or 12 minutes later, he rises up to attack some people on the ship, and then get killed again.
I thought the same thing. We are wrong. That was not...
Oh, it's not Beardy.
No. It was Scottish punk.
Well, they certainly didn't do a
somehow very
good job
other people
of that.
Figure that out, that he falls face first in the acid, in the black goo. The black goo turns him into spider zombie.
Oh.
So again, it has a different effect on everyone. I thought the same thing.
Okay, because then I'm thinking it's redundant because this is a studio person saying you need an action beat here.
Right. But it's still redundant and pointless. It just answers the question of what happened to Scottish punk. But because it does is raise new questions like, well, why did the black goo do that to him and this to that guy? And what is... Here's the thing. The first movie, the first hour sets up all this different stuff. And again, what is still working about the movie is that it's asking questions. And I don't mean big questions like, where do we come from? It's just open-ended questions like the first hour of any movie does that you want to see answered in the second hour. And then the second hour happens, and it basically answers none of those questions.
Because in the second hour, we get See You in 2 Summers.
It just introduces new nonsense and goes off in all these different directions. Characters act. I can't think of a character in this movie that makes the right choice, with the exception of Charlize Theron. I mean, I kept waiting to find out, whoa, why does David behave the way he does? Why does he decide to infect that scientist? Why? I mean, you get the impression that he resents constantly being reminded that he is not human.
But there's another element here, and that too is borrowed from 2001, that David has programming that the other characters are not aware of, that he's certainly not telling anyone. David's taking orders from old guy.
Right.
And old guy is sort of interested in how all of this alien engineer goo is going to play out. So just like Hal, who either has different programming or Hal misunderstands the programming and starts to see the men getting in the way of the actual mission, the David character is going about doing his business, acting in a way that he's been programmed to do.
I just think...
I mean, it's hardly subtle. He deliberately infects Beardy.
Right. But you'd never really understand why, and if it's really under orders from Guy Pearce in terrible old man makeup, what was the... I mean, what was the end game? What is he trying to figure... What happens if we eat the black goo? That's science? That's what they've spent billions of dollars on this science experiment for? Well, try feeding it to a guy. See what happens. And then there's no... They don't actually try and... study the effects or anything. It's like, oh, he's possessed, torch him. Charlize Theron is really the only character who makes reasonably intelligent decisions.
And they're all based on self-preservation. And I believe it's her who has one of the strangest lines in the film.
Father? That one? Because we didn't understand that that was her dad.
Well, I actually thought that was one of the worst line readings I've ever heard, because I began to think...
It was unbelievably bad.
There are actors who could have turned that into something, because it's such a bad, blatantly written line.
We get it.
You have to give it a spin. But at one point, isn't it the Charlize Theron character who says, all of us wish to see our parents dead? I don't. Is this a universal truth that I'm not in?
Yes. But this is a movie, this is another example of the movie thinking that it's addressing these big ideas about, like, where did we come from, and who is David's creator, and who is Charlize Theron's creator, and who is this facehugger's creator, because this girl can't give birth, and who is her creator? It's her dead mom and her dead dad.
But there's always a problem here, and this is going to seem like a tremendous tangent, but it's not, that when you're dealing with universal truth, you have to get it. You have to hit it on the head.
Yeah.
And the example I always use is George Carlin used to do this amazing routine where he said, did you ever reach into the bread to get to the good bread? And that makes everyone laugh, because right. everyone's done
right.
that.
Right.
Every
right.
single person has done that. And you're like, yes, right. everyone's done right. that.
You can't just say something and then call it a universal truth.
And then Eddie Murphy, at his most awful, when he was doing stand-up, that movie stand-up.
Oh, yeah, thing, yeah. Raw.
Started doing these routines. Did you ever find when the right. bitch gets mouthy and
right.
you're like...
And tries to take half your money, half of your millions.
And like, I'm like, no. Right. That right. several times in the last half hour of Prometheus, I felt that they were presenting these things. Well, of course we all agree. We all want our parents to... No. I know people who would like their parents to be alive again.
Right, right.
Who are not happy that they're dead.
I find, again, in the little bit of reading that I've done, I don't want to shit on anybody's enjoyment of this movie, or, like, if somebody really loved it, great, I'm happy that you saw a movie that you loved, but I find that some people seem to be ascribing meanings to the movie that aren't there, and I think they're saying that the movie is smart in being deliberately vague or obtuse, but I don't think that's true. I don't think... that's what the movie is doing. I think the movie is underwritten in a bad way. I don't think David's motivations are meant to be vague or obtuse. I think the movie just never does a good job of addressing them.
And certainly there are other examples in the film of the film being underwritten in other ways where we could, you know, excuse us for jumping to the conclusion
right,
that
right.
the screenwriters aren't doing their job. But this presents a quandary, because if the film then is this maddeningly oblique thing that is making some people have meditations in the theater that are great, I find it hard to differentiate between Prometheus doing that and the films of Errol Morris. When I sit through an Errol Morris film, they seem to be fertilizer for me to do some very deep thinking about mm-hmm. the subject that Errol Morris... So how are they different? That Errol Morris is better at it, or because he did it on purpose?
Yeah, right. I mean,
if Prometheus is making you have big thoughts that you've never thought about before, it's hard for me to be against that.
Absolutely. And it would be bullshit on my part to suggest that people are searching for those big thoughts or questions or answers because they deliberately seek out to do that, that they were so primed for this Ridley Scott science fiction movie that ties into this franchise that they love, that they go into it, that like I said earlier, that they're rationalizing the gaps in the movie by saying, like, no, this is on purpose. That's an example of the virgin birth. Like,
and
there's no evidence to suggest that's the example of the virgin birth.
But didn't we see...
Men can't have children either, right? but John Hurt getting the chestburster was not the virgin birth.
Didn't we see examples of that in Lost as well?
Absolutely.
Where the elisions were seen as
yes.
very deliberate and yes. very deep.
Yes.
But again, we're always championing ambitious failures.
Yes.
Hollywood films are so interested in nothing.
Yes.
We have to give this film a dime of credit for being a summer blockbuster that dares to say, where did we come from?
Yes, I agree with that. And that's why I don't think it's a completely bad movie. But I also think that just saying, where did we come from, isn't enough unless you're willing to...
I agree. And going back to 2001...
Right. Right.
Kubrick...
Right.
Kubrick has an answer.
Right.
And Kubrick's answer isn't, in 2 years, I'm going to grab $12 more of your money.
And I almost feel like they figured that out at the very end. That was never the intent, although I know that it kind of was, because every movie now has to just set up a franchise. But I almost feel like they got to 2 hours, and they thought, oh, we didn't answer that? Let's leave it open-ended for a sequel.
And the sequel is going to be called The Amazing Adventures of Dr. Shaw and A Head in a Bag.
I
like The Head in the Bag.
Sure, that's fine. But again, it doesn't make any sense knowing what she knows about David. Why is she taking him with her? She knows that he, not necessarily deliberately infected her, but he was the one who knew what she had in her stomach and wasn't going to help her get it out. I mean,
I don't think the scriptwriters have done any of this legwork, but I would argue that now that David's owner is dead, or seems to be,
yes,
that might make him more whatever.
Right. But again, and also we're making a leap there.
He'll be more manageable as just a head.
Just a head in a bag.
And he has demonstrated that he can speak the engineer's language.
Which that doesn't necessarily make any sense either. And we don't know what he says at the end. And that's, I guess that's fine. But it's just, it's a movie that's more interested in these. And this is the game that Lost played. It was just, you have to just keep introducing new, well, what's this? Well, what's this?
Yeah.
But what's this?
You just keep piling it on.
You can't do that for a movie.
I will give the film this. By the time we get to the scene where the David robot is talking to the engineer, I think they've done a good enough job, or maybe Fassbender has jumped the script to do a good enough job, that what he might be saying to the engineer is not what yes. Guy Pearce told him to say to the engineer.
Yes.
And I think that's kind of cool.
In a better movie, in
of
which...
Of course, if that's the way you're going, why not subtitle
well, that's
what
the
he's
thing,
saying
right.
and let us know?
In a better movie, now that scene becomes about David overriding his programming and...
And becoming more
defying
human.
Defying his creator
because
to, do,
as we,
to make a choice.
Because as we've discovered in the film, humans are doing that all the time. That's
right.
what makes us human. This
right.
is what I choose to believe.
Right. So that's a scene that works. But instead, we're just left guessing, well, maybe that's what it is. And suddenly we're going to give Prometheus all this credit for being this thoughtful blockbuster.
And I actually thought, because the alien engineer places his hand on David's head, that somehow the engineer could tell that he wasn't a human being. And that's one of the things that pissed him off.
Perhaps. Let's talk real quick about all the monster stuff, because I don't think the movie needs any of it. And again, that's why I go back to... The ways in which it ties into Alien are unnecessary. It doesn't add anything to the movie, really. Because the movie that we're talking about, where it's questions about, and you're asking the engineers, and where do we come from, and we find aliens, and all that. I could deal with all that, but black goo and crazy weapons that has a different impact, it has a different effect on everyone, is no good.
It seems to me that Prometheus is presenting a whole bunch of rough drafts for the alien. That snake that the biologist describes as beautiful, and he refers to it as a she.
And can we talk again about all of the bad decisions that the characters make, including the fact that for 15 minutes we've watched these guys be scared of everything, and they just want to get out of the cave. Why they don't just stay in one place, I don't understand. But they're scared of everything. And then this monster pops out of a puddle, and he decides to pet it.
Well, and that's something that I thought right away was odd, and why I refer to those two as Abbott and Costello. All of the scientists, during that sequence, it comes up several times. It's not implicit. It's explicit. don't touch anything.
Right.
And all of them proceed to touch everything.
Taking their helmets off. Like, hey, that's good science, everyone. Hey, we're on this crazy planet. We're in a cave. Let's see what happens if I take my helmet off. It's as scientific as, what happens if I feed him the black goo? Let's see. And that character, I don't remember the boyfriend's name. Holloway.
See, I thought they were married.
Right. They could be married. I don't know.
In the Mad Magazine parody of Prometheus, he will be called Hollowhead because he behaves so stupidly.
Well, he spends, what, his whole life, his whole adult life, trying to read these symbols and find an alien civilization. He does, successfully.
And when he discovers he can't talk to them...
Mwah, I'm gonna drink.
Let's just go home.
It's the stupidest...
Well, that's your girlfriend is interested in this. Maybe you could be happy that her part is
You don't think you might still have something to learn? This is your character arc? They're all gone?
Aww. I'm going home.
Shucks, pass me the vodka with the black goo in it.
I'm going to go home with my tail between my legs as soon as I grow a tail.
And let me ask you this question. If the engineers... planted life on Earth, or some other planet, as Ridley Scott would say, and then got pissed at us for killing Jesus, and decided, oh, let's make a bioweapon out of black goo to take them out, even though, I don't know, it seems like there are better ways to do that, but okay.
Especially if it's 2,000 years ago. It seems to me with their
It took them 2,000 years to cultivate the black goo. And then where the worms came from, I don't know, because there weren't any life forms in there. Right? Oh, no, there's worms. Okay, and now they mutate into this, and then that mutates into that. Anyway.
Well, they're terraforming.
Why do they spend...
The film is in love with that word.
Why, then, do they spend, you know, 2,000 years A.D. giving us a map of where to find them? Is it just so we'll bring the weapon home with us? Because if they have the capabilities of coming to Earth... to terraform, why not just bring the black goo to us? Why all these cave paintings in which we are pointing where to go?
I think that's a question of chronology, and I may be wrong, but the way I interpreted it was all of the cave paintings were from kind aliens visiting us.
Mm.
Let's see how they're doing. And the kindly aliens that are pictured on the cave walls are pointing to where they came from, and you get that five-ball sequence.
It's
and
not that, AD, too, by the way. It is BC, I apologize.
And that this right. was before they yes. got mad.
Yes, you're right.
That there's a
you're right.
there's a break there.
But I just... I read a theory that, oh, there's two different, like, not races of engineers, but there's nice engineers and then angry engineers who want to kill us, and the nice ones are pointing us to their planet, and the angry ones are trying to kill us with black goo. But again, I just don't see how you could call a movie a success. I don't think the movie is open to all these interpretations because of something right the movie has done. I think people are trying to fill in the gaps in places where the movie has failed.
Very much like Rocky Horror Picture Show, that when you watch it without an audience, you wonder why there's such long pauses between the dialogue. Oh, yeah. That's for the audience to fill in
right,
the joke.
Right. I think... Fassbender as the lead is more interesting, not only because he gives the best performance, not only because he's the closest thing to a character that the movie has, but because thematically he ties in to what the movie is about. If mankind is trying to figure out who created me, he's trying to understand why he was created, and of course the answer is, well, because we can. Like, oh, great. Way to answer that. Way to wrap that up, guys. But I also would argue that Charlize Theron, who doesn't give a good performance, who doesn't have a character to play, would also be a more interesting lead in the movie because she's the one who doesn't want to be there. She's the one who's only interested in self-preservation. As stupid as it is when she dies because the giant spaceship falls on her because she refuses to run sideways and just run straight, I will say, and maybe I'm a crazy person for saying this, her death was the only one that actually affected me. And not in just a that's so stupid way. It's just that right up to the moment where she died, she was saying, no, 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 no. She's the only one who's demonstrated any survival instincts through the entire movie.
Which is one thing that makes us human.
She desperately wants to live.
And I thought her character could have been the linchpin in a better film that explored the father-child relationship, both between the engineers and all of us, and her rich father and her, which in a weird, odd way, in a better movie, would have made her and David brother and sister,
right.
And that could have been explored instead of her treating him like a butler. This film is crying out to be so much more than it is.
Right.
And again, like you said, it lays the seeds to let us do the fan fiction and make it into a better movie.
I read a theory that she's a robot. Because Idris Elba introduces that in what's supposed to be a joke, and it is, you know. But again, you're providing negative evidence for things that aren't there. You're saying, well, maybe she's a robot. Okay, maybe they're all robots then, because why are we assuming that she's a robot?
And here's a weird elision. At one point, she comes down and she and Idris Elba speak, and Idris Elba wants to sleep with her.
Right.
And she doesn't want to do this.
Right.
And 5 minutes later, she said, meet me at my place in 5 minutes.
Right.
And then that scene is missing.
Where they have sex?
Yeah.
No, that scene exists. And again, this is terrible screenwriting. So that Idris Elba is away from his post while the two goofy guys fall in the black goo and get the arm broken by the snake.
Right. No, I understand narrative-wise. I understand in terms of the carpentry of the plot that they did.
Right.
But why don't we... Not that I really needed a hot sex scene between Idris Elba and Charlize Theron. Black on white.
America's not ready.
Why is that left out?
I don't know. I don't know. When at the end of the movie... there's a ticking clock because they're going to crash the ship because they've decided this is what we have to do on a whim because Idris Elba alone has figured out that what they're creating is a weapon and spoken that in a very clumsy line of exposition.
At the end, he becomes this fountain
of things. How do you figure this out? He's been on the ship the whole time, just watching stuff on a video.
It's like the crazy character in bad movies. At the beginning, that's all exposition.
Right.
Suddenly, he becomes Basil Exposition at the end.
So she's trying to get off the ship, right? And I assume that she's getting in what they've described as a lifeboat, because that was established earlier on.
And it's not a very good one.
That's not even what she gets in, right? She gets in, like, a weird booster seat that launches her 50 feet away from the ship. She's still stuck on this goddamn planet. Why was that there? I don't know. Why set up the lifeboat? Again, I know it's...
I expected her whole apartment to break off.
Right! Because that's what they've set up to do. And why can't she get away? Why does... I mean, we have to punish her because she's the bad corporate... Like, she's not Paul Reiser.
But at
Aliens.
One point, Numi walks into the fancy apartment, and it's all busted up, and there's stuff coming from the ceiling. Could that be why she took the shitty escape pod? Because escape apartment... The Barbie dream house had been destroyed.
I don't understand. And the last thing I'll bring up is, what is the point of having Guy Pearce along? Again, did it feel like an afterthought to you? I mean, I understand that it turns out that really he's the one who wants to meet the aliens so that he can extend his life. But it all felt like such an afterthought. And the reveal was so not a reveal. And why pretend to be dead in the first place?
And maybe in a better film, as we've discussed, or maybe in an earlier version of this, that is something that he and his daughter have in common. There's this thread here that they're very interested in self-preservation. And this entire thing has been bankrolled because this guy doesn't want to die.
Right.
And how interesting that, as different as you might be, your daughter is very much on board with that.
Mm-hmm.
That he wants to meet his maker. But it must be the biggest act of optimism in history, at least the reality of history that the film is presenting, that this guy has spent trillions of dollars on the dubious notion that if you can meet your maker, the first thing your maker is going to do is going to say, you get to live forever.
Right.
You get the Bozo Big Top prize because you found me. So now God is part of a scavenger hunt, and if we find God, the prize is eternal life? Thank you, Damon Lindelof. This explains Lost to me.
Is there an earlier draft? Are there deleted scenes? Is it for the sequels in which we see Waylon as a young man?
It has to be. And earlier in the podcast, that suddenly occurred to me. Oh, they're going to take the makeup off.
Because why else are you casting Guy Pearce in distractingly bad old man makeup?
And it was so thick and so crazy. That's why I thought it was Fassbender.
Right.
It's clearly not 100 and... I mean, he's supposed to be really old, yeah. but his money has enabled him to.
But not live forever. For that, you have to follow the cave paintings.
I like that thing they put him in that lets him walk, though. I thought that was cool. Especially the Foley that they did on
yeah.
that. It
yeah.
makes little noises.
It's a frustrating movie. I'm very frustrated by this movie.
But again, I will give it something. Sometimes my wife and I measure a film by whether it gives you something to talk about
Absolutely.
On the ride home. And this one certainly does.
But this is part of my problem, too, is that the people who are giving this movie a pass, and again, if you like it, great, are saying it asks these big questions. It's giving you stuff to talk about. But the stuff that it's giving you to talk about isn't like, well, what do you think the nature of our existence is? How do you think we were created? Oh, by aliens who then tried to kill us. The stuff that it's giving you to talk about is all the ways it fucks up. Like, that's all we've done, is talk about why did they do this? We're talking about bad filmmaking. We're not talking about the questions, air quotes, that the movie ponders. Because I don't think it has given us enough substance to actually address those questions. I don't think it's given us the material to have that conversation. I think the conversations that we can have are, hey, let's list the ways in which this movie is a mess.
And one of the reasons for all the elisions, I think, is that this movie is trying to do five things at the same time.
And one of them is to be a prequel to Alien. And why is it a prequel to Alien? Why does any of that matter? What does the story of the Prometheus trying to figure out the birth of mankind have to do with Alien?
It's the marketing hook.
Oh, God, it's so frustrating. Just get rid of it. Just get rid of it.
Maybe we're looking at a more modern equivalent of, I'm such a fan of the Mummy remake. Because someone said, I certainly don't like the sequels, but someone came up with the idea, well, the way to do the Mummy is that it's Indiana Jones, and go with it.
Right.
That someone had this very thoughtful script a long time ago that was a very hard sell until someone said, you know,
maybe
this could be an Alien prequel.
Right, maybe. I mean, I know that, you know, for years, I'm sure Fox has been trying to get more Alien movies off the ground because it's a big moneymaker for them. It's a big franchise for them. But I wish that when Ridley Scott did come out and say, you know what, this has taken on a life of its own, it's this other thing now, that he wasn't bullshitting us, that it really was just Prometheus.
And did Resurrection make money?
Yeah, I believe so.
Because you're with me on this, Resurrection's a mess.
Yeah.
Both literally and figuratively.
Yeah.
I mean, that's one of the ugliest films I've ever
There's
seen.
There's things in it that I like, though. This is for a different podcast. I like that at a certain point, Alien is great. It's so great. I love Aliens. I think that movie's so great. And then I'm almost able to divorce anything else that comes afterwards
yeah.
as this weird, let's let this guy have a spin at it. Let's let that it becomes
it
different
becomes
cover
fiction.
Versions of the same songs. Yeah. And so we get to see all these different weird interpretations. And I like that that's a crazy French interpretation. I don't think it works as a movie. It's a huge mess. But so is Alien 3. And now that movie gets a pass because everybody likes David Fincher. And they're like, no, it's better than we thought. No, it isn't, guys. You just like David Fincher now. That movie sucks. And the Alien vs. Predator movies, I don't even count. But
I'm waiting for Freddy versus Alien.
The movie would have still been a
My
mess.
My money's on Alien.
The movie would have still been a mess without any of the Alien stuff. But I feel like by including it, it becomes a much more cynical exercise, and that makes me angry at the movie.
Modern Hollywood? Cynicism?
And it distracts.
Surely you just.
The monster stuff in the second half just distracts from everything else, and I don't need to see a giant face hugger in long, lingering close-ups impregnate an engineer so that we can see how the alien was born. It's midichlorians. It's all... That's where this came from. I don't care. I prefer to think, oh, it's scary because I don't know where it's from or what it's capable of.
Where could that have
been? Right.
The mystery of it.
That's why an alien is scary.
That's why it's Alien.
Right.
Because we don't.
God damn it.
I think we have a new entry for our glossary, midichlorians, to describe that entire phenomenon.
Prequels are always a bad idea, everyone.
You know, I could have predicted this when I went to see Butch and Sundance, the early years.
Or Dumb and Dumberer.
I didn't see that.
No, I did.
I learned my lesson.
Thanks for listening, everybody. Remember, you can find us at fthismovie.blogspot.com.
And remember that everyone wants to see their parents dead, so kill them tonight.